everyone. Thank you so much for tuning in for this episode, in which I am thrilled to welcome back Dr. Sarah Smith to the podcast. For this one, we discuss something that, in light of more recent changes in some state laws, is maybe becoming a little more common in veterinary medicine. This is a highly entertaining episode. Sorry, I can't help myself. What is this job if you can't have a little fun with the "your dog got into weed" conversation? That's right, we're talking about THC toxicity in dogs. Anyhow, this episode was born out of a talk that Dr. Smith gave several years ago that I found very impactful. I thought her talk did a great job of illustrating that maybe there's more to this intoxication than "they'll be fine, let them sleep it off." Now, fortunately, that's probably going to be the case for most of these critters, but being able to recognize some of the more classic signs of THC intoxication, both in terms of patient history and physical exam, can be an important part of stopping us from going down a rabbit hole of pricey diagnostics and scary differentials and things like that. And if you happen to get one of these less common cases that's a little bit more severe and needs treatment beyond "give them some time, let them sleep it off," there are some important considerations to keep in mind when designing a treatment plan for these patients and communicating with the owners. Dr. Smith does an amazing job of walking us through some of these considerations around THC intoxication, and we dive into a few of the cases she has managed, which I love because I always love breaking these cases down. So I really hope you enjoy this episode and learn a lot. Dr. Smith spent over a decade in emergency medicine and now enjoys using her experience to keep pets healthy as a general practitioner on the East Coast. She's passionate about teaching, having spent several years as a faculty member with Colorado State University's Veterinary Teaching Hospital. Her professional interests are in pain management, toxicities, trauma, and soft tissue surgery. And I can confirm that because my interest is not necessarily in soft tissue surgery, and she has bailed me out on several occasions with her excellent surgical skills. So let's go ahead and get into this talk. Like I said, I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Well, I'm really excited to be joined by my friend and colleague. We were Thursday buddies, weren't we, when we worked together at the hospital?
Yes, Thursday buddies. I miss those days.
Me too. Dr. Sarah Smith, who is no longer my Thursday buddy, but still someone I call and talk to frequently about my clinical and just life questions, let's be honest. But for this episode, we're going to talk about THC toxicity, which I came to you with this topic because I remember, actually before we worked together, you gave this really fantastic presentation on THC intoxication in dogs, and it went beyond the typical, like, "oh, they'll be fine," you know, just kind of monitor, and was really, I don't know, it kind of stuck with me. So I'm excited to be talking about it again.
I'm glad to hear it stuck with you. Hopefully I can give more people information.
I'm sure. I'm putting the pressure on here. No, I'm just kidding. Well, so starting with, you know, kind of how you came to maybe talk about this topic on the presentation that I'm referring to, like, why do you think talking about THC toxicity is an important thing that we should cover in veterinary medicine?
Good question. And, you know, I'll tell you, I probably have had more exposure to a lot of THC toxicity patients than others may have, just because of the geography in which I've lived. And where I went to vet school was Colorado. And then I was in Southern California, and I was in Washington State, kind of when it became legalized for the first time in Washington and Colorado, and back to Colorado. And while those were the first states to legalize this, there are more and more states legalizing either medicinal marijuana or, you know, different forms of products containing THC. And I think it's something that more people are seeing throughout the country. And, you know, there were even some studies about the rates of increase in THC toxicity in pets as legalization was becoming more prevalent. And so I think it's becoming an increasingly seen toxicity. But also, it's important to recognize both so you can sometimes alleviate an owner's concern of, you know, no, this isn't something absolutely horrible. It is a toxicity and it's treatable and recoverable. to also veterinarians recognizing it and not completely blowing it off, because rarely it can have very severe effects.
Absolutely. You know, with Florida being one of those states that has kind of moved towards legalization, I agree with you that it is a toxicity that we're seeing more and more. And fortunately, like you said, when we get that diagnosis, it usually serves to kind of ease the owner's fears. That was certainly the case of the last intoxication that I saw. It was an old lab, so kind of everything was on the table as far as why he was acutely neurologic. And we'll talk about the clinical signs a little bit more, but he had some giveaways where I was able to talk to the owner about it, and it turned out it was THC intoxication. And you know, I was able to alleviate his fears, like you said, and say, you know, it's okay. He didn't get very much. We just need to let him kind of rest and he'll be okay. But sometimes in talking to these owners, we have to get a little creative, both in terms of making it a safe place for them to disclose that their dog got into marijuana, but also what form of marijuana, because I know that has been rapidly changing. You mentioned you were in Washington when it first became legal, and I know now there's a lot more regulation around the forms and how much can be in each type of formulation. So what are, maybe if you will, kind of review some of the forms of THC that dogs might get into. And I know there's some out there that maybe we don't think of.
Yeah, absolutely. And honestly, when I was first an emergency veterinarian, I didn't know all of the different types and terms. I still don't, probably, even after researching presentations on the topic. But it's important to recognize that not all marijuana products or THC products are all the same across the board, and they can have pretty profound differences in toxicity effects. For example, I had an owner call the ER once and say, hey, my dog got into skunk. And meanwhile, I'm like, oh yeah, here's a recipe for hydrogen peroxide baths,
yeah.
You know, like a skunk. No, no, skunk is a very bred form of marijuana plant with a high concentration of THC in it. And so we had to shift our conversation. He didn't get skunked. He got into a very concentrated form of THC. And these are just the plants that are grown to have higher THC levels. They go by like skunk, haze, kush. See, I can't even get all the terms.
It reminds me of, did you ever watch The Office? And like, there's an episode where Dwight finds marijuana in the parking lot, and he brings it in, and he's like interviewing everyone, and he brings Creed in, and he's like, do you know what this is? And he has like a picture of a pot leaf, and he's like, it's like, I don't know, he goes in some like elaborate name for what the plant was, and Dwight just shakes his head, he's like, no, it's marijuana, and like, he's all disappointed because there's so many names.
Right. Well, the first time I gave a presentation about THC intoxication was in Colorado to a bunch of veterinary students. And I felt very embarrassed trying to go over the forums because I'm like, I'm sure many of you in this room know a lot more about this than I do.
Right. I know, it's kind of one of those things too, where you're like, yeah, you know, you learn more about it as it becomes, you know, more available and we're seeing more of these presentations. But yeah, there's always, you know, kind of these different forums out there that I'm with you. I feel kind of silly when I try to talk about it because I'm like, I'm sure I'm not saying the right words and getting right. The right terminology.
And it's not so important that we get it exactly right from that standpoint, but that we recognize and know, hey, this is a form of something that could have high levels of THC. That means we better take this a little more seriously and, you know, really figure this out. It's also true for things that are like THC, called synthetic cannabinoids. And those, again, go by a bunch of different names, like spice, K2, liquid incense. I'm sure there's more current ones. But essentially, these are typically more dangerous even than a lot of THC compounds.
Those are worse, aren't they?
They can be. I mean, basically, there's so many compounds that can fall into that category. It's like a mixture of herbs and spices that are then sprayed with synthetic compounds that are made to interact like THC with the receptors we have in our body that THC interacts with, the different, you know, CB receptors. And sometimes those bind a lot more tightly and can be a lot more concentrated. And, you know, some of the human toxicities tend to be more related to synthetics.
Absolutely. And that would make sense that, you know, you're going with this synthetic formulation that, yeah, would interact with those cannabinoid receptors much differently. That sounds, hopefully we can stick with just like the normal stuff that we know how to treat.
That would be nice. And actually, the synthetic cannabinoids are often more available in places where marijuana is not legalized
Okay.
because they can kind of get around laws with some of this stuff and creating new compounds. And so sometimes it's sold at like a gas station
Right.
as spice and, you know, something to be cautious of and people might not be as aware of.
Yeah, so absolutely. So even if you're in an area where it's not legalized in any form, yeah, absolutely being aware of the different formulations and what they look like and yeah, what they're called, because I would have had the same reaction if somebody told me their dog got into skunk. Having had a dog that got skunked, well, yeah, that seems also very serious to me, but in a very different way.
Well, there's one called wax, which is like marijuana
Oh.
concentrate. Again, can be very concentrated forms of THC.
Okay.
And you know, if someone called and said their dog got into wax, I would probably blow that off.
Yeah. Oh gosh. So yeah, so if any pet owners get a hold of this one, like be specific, please, as far as
Yes.
what did they get into?
And veterinarians ask clarifying questions, you know.
Yeah.
And if you don't know what something is, like hashish, look it up. Because I
Sure.
wouldn't have known previously, but you know, that again, very high levels of THC.
Well, I think also some of the other intoxications that we get called about. I remember in vet school, I was on my emergency rotation senior year, yes. And someone came in and said, my dog ate a whole tray of brownies. And it was a really big dog. And like, we weren't super concerned about chocolate intoxication in this guy. But I went back to the resident that I was working with and I said, yeah, this person's concerned. They say their dog got into a whole tray of brownies. And they looked at me dead serious. First question they asked were like, was it full of weed? And I'm like, I don't know. I didn't ask, but maybe I should have. So yeah, even some of the other intoxications, like someone may be more willing to tell you that their dog ate a tray of brownies than their dog ate a tray of weed brownies.
Very true. And I think there's been several instances where people have said their dog got into brownies, and later I found out it was indeed pot brownies.
So a legitimate question to ask if
Legitimate.
you get my dog got into brownies.
Well, at least especially in Colorado, we saw that a
Sure,
lot.
I could see that. What about like liquids and things like that? There's even like incense, there's some weird forms like that. It sounds like not so much the forms that we need to be aware of, but maybe more the terminology.
Correct. The most important is probably understanding which forms have high concentrations of THC or maybe synthetic cannabinoids that just have less reliable behaviors. It's also important to know a little bit about how marijuana or THC is used in edibles, because I think that's been where I've seen the most severe toxicities in general and most frequent is people taking advantage of the high lipid solubility of THC will make some pot butter to make brownies or other, you know, cookies, yummy baked goods, like we were talking about, come in with the empty pan of brownies. And when they do that, they actually take the marijuana leaves and cook those in a vat of butter. They'll cook that plant material in butter or oil. And because THC is fat soluble, it will go into that product. They'll strain the leaves and then use the butter or oil for cooking. And you can imagine they might say, like, oh, whatever, I'll just throw this in my backyard, the like pieces of leaves
Oh
coated in oil and
gosh.
butter. And of course, that looks amazing to their dog.
Do we know if that's maybe even more highly absorbed when the dogs eat that because it's coated in oil?
Well, typically the oil or butter itself will have the high concentrations of THC at that point. And people will usually try to get most of that out for
Fair.
their own consumption. However, I have seen some extremely severe toxicities from just eating the scraps because they're getting the plant material with all of that other stuff coated. And yes, it can definitely lead to severe toxicity.
So let's talk about those severe toxicities, or even, you know, maybe like on a spectrum from mild to severe. How do these patients typically present?
Good question. And I would say a majority are not severe. Most are mild, but very concerning if you don't know that it's THC causing the signs. And so often owners will see them, you know, startling easily, just not acting themselves, walking wobbly. They'll seem to be maybe a little dull or sleepy, and sometimes hyperactive, complete opposite. And sometimes they will vomit.
Okay.
Owners don't always notice this, but often the vet staff, I feel like, notice it when they first come in, that the patients will dribble a little bit of urine.
Ding, ding, ding. That was the one that cued me in on the case I was talking about earlier.
That's my favorite, because if owners say it, even better. But a lot of the time, it's like little dribbles of pee, and people will sometimes miss that. But if your staff are wonderful like mine were and could catch that, it really helps clue me in about THC toxicity, because not a lot of things do that.
Yes. And it's a, like, when they get to that point where they're dribbling urine, it can look very dramatic with these clinical signs, because they're, you know, they're stumbling. And like you said, they're startling easily. So they're jumpy and they're stumbling and they're, you know, dribbling urine. And so, yeah, if you don't put all those signs together and say, oh, I know what causes this, it can look really scary, especially if you have like an older patient where there's a lot of possibilities.
Oh, for sure. And I've actually written down quotes that owners have said to me as to their presenting complaint that later I confirmed were related to THC toxicity.
Oh, please share.
Well, one of them is more along the lines of what I wish everyone would say, which is, oh, he started acting real jumpy and he's peeing everywhere.
Ah, love
and
that.
And yeah, that's like, oh, thank you for giving me my likely diagnosis. That's fantastic. Very often, I feel like they'll say, you know, he just started acting wobbly and falling over. And that's a scary one. You know, that could be a lot of different things, but marijuana would be one of the best possibilities. And then was fine acting himself earlier and then just suddenly started acting drunk.
Sure.
And that for me is one of those, you know, you do want to rule out more serious toxins. Ethylene glycol, of course, can lead to them suddenly acting drunk as well. So, you know, that you would want to catch and wouldn't want to just hope it was THC toxicity and miss something else. So I do get into, you know, ruling out other things when we're looking here. You know, you don't want to only get tunnel vision and see THC toxicity after we talk about it.
But yes, and I think that's a good reminder with ethylene glycol, because, you know, I always think of kidney damage and, you know, calcium oxalate, monohydrate, and this kind of stuff with ethylene glycol. Sometimes I forget about that, like, drunken stagger that they can get with that.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, you don't want to just blow that off and make sure we're thinking of the wide range. But more often I've seen it from THC intoxication. Again, biased by where I have lived.
Sure, and fortunately, because that's a lot easier to treat than ethylene glycol.
Very true. I am thankful that the places I have lived have not given me as many ethylene glycols.
Yes. Yeah. Especially because some of them have been cold places. So definitely a possibility.
Yeah. And then, of course, there's that, I think my neighbor poisoned our dog.
Yes. I got that one and it was actually true. And it was ethylene glycol.
Oh, well, that's tragic.
Yeah, it was. It was really sad.
You know, I would say most of the time I get that complaint, it's actually not a toxin or a neighbor's revenge. But most of the time, I think it's a bleeding splenic mass or pericardial effusion.
Sure.
Which, you know, strange to have the presenting complaint of, I think my neighbor poisoned our dog. But I think anything that acutely changes them, that's people's go-to.
Right.
Makes me a little concerned for how many people have neighbors they think would poison their animals.
Yeah, I know. And I'm like, what kind of relationship do you guys have with your neighbors?
Yeah, a little concerning.
Yeah. And like I said, the one I've heard it a million times. There was one time it was actually true. And it's ironic. There was an ethylene glycol toxicity that was very tragic. But certainly for the one time I've seen it actually be true, I've heard it hundreds of times over and seen it not be true at all. And it's exactly what you're saying. It's anything that changes them acutely, you know, particularly if they get lethargic or neurologic.
For sure. And then I think my favorite of all the quotes I wrote down was, I think he got crushed in the couch.
Oh.
Well, it turned out this little adorable chihuahua was laying with his owner as she was recovering from a procedure she'd had. And the owner kind of woke up and saw that the Chihuahua was acting off and seemed very reactive to everything. And so they immediately went to, oh my gosh, I must have crushed them in the couch. And it turns out, you know, when asked more about what they had to help them while they were recovering, I mean, they had THC right there, and it was much more likely the cause of this dog's illness.
Sure. Although not, you know, like hugely far-fetched that he got stuck in the couch, because, I mean, I guess I think of, like, if he did get crushed and he was painful, maybe, like, every time he got touched, he was like, ah, oh, don't touch me, ah, oh, don't touch me. But more often than not, I feel like when that happens and they're painful, like in their back or their neck or something, they just don't move at all.
True. And you're right, though, the description absolutely could have been, it's just the physical exam signs we saw told me that was less likely, which I guess we could touch on those kind of physical exam findings too, if you'd like.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is so variable because THC can affect them in slightly different ways. So I'd say most often they're dull or obtunded, you know, definitely seeming sleepy. But if they especially just had a bunch of stimulation, like a car ride to the veterinary office, they may instead seem a little bit more reactive and truly what we call the hyperesthesia or hyperesthetic. So they're now more alert, but in an altered state, much more reactive than you'd expect for basic things like a bright light.
So that makes sense, because when you said dull and obtunded, I went, man, if I have one that comes in that's like really dull or obtunded, I'm really concerned. Like, I feel like that would be a pretty severe toxicity. But you're right, like maybe we're not seeing that as much because they're taking these car rides to the clinic and getting stimulated.
Exactly. Like if the ER had a really long wait, I feel like by the time you'd get into a room, you know, that patient would be much more, you know, lethargic and sleeping it off in their owner's arms.
Sure.
But most of the time they're brought straight back, examined, and they seem more agitated than necessarily dull, even if the owner was seeing them really dull at home.
So either a dull to obtunded mentation or a hyperesthetic, kind of agitated mentation, staggering, drunken, ataxic gait, and dribbling urine would be kind of our hallmark signs. Does that include some of the more severe intoxications that you've seen?
Good question. Those are a little bit different when they're at the most severe. Backing up just a little bit, I would say the other like physical exam findings on a lot of the more mild ones, I will also notice like they will be kind of dull if you're watching them sit with their owner, and then they'll be hyperesthetic when you're doing their menace or, you know, looking at their PLRs. But despite seeming really nervous about you touching them or bright lights, they will have a low heart rate. So they'll be fairly bradycardic. And typically they'll have a low body temperature. Although occasionally if they've just been through that really stressful car ride to the hospital, they might have a normal or even a little hyperthermic from the shaking and, you know, oh man, this is all so scary.
Yes, like weird things are happening that I don't understand. I just had this snack and all of a sudden I feel funny.
Yes. And but moving on to your question about the severe ones, in the most severe ones I've seen are really dull to obtunded. You can't get a response from them even if you try to stimulate, or they can sometimes actually be hyperesthetic to the point they're having like tremors or seizures. Though I would say more commonly in my experience it's been that really dull, you have to like poke at them to try to get them to take a breath.
Oh gosh. Those
yeah
are severe.
Right. That is not the most common for sure, but I've seen it a decent number of times.
Wow.
And have had one patient I was involved with that we actually did have to ventilate.
Wow.
Not the common, but important to be aware of.
Yeah, just that to know that it can happen. So if we have one that's kind of presenting with that classic presentation that we described earlier, we may be able to get a pretty accurate diagnosis just off of history and physical exam. But if we have one of these that's really dull, and like you said, we're kind of having to poke at them and stimulate them to get them to take a breath, to try to maintain their body temperature and this type of things, if we don't have an owner that is readily forthcoming with the fact that their dog got into something, How do we get that diagnosis in a dog that isn't fitting the classical presentation?
Really good question. And honestly, most of the time, history is the most important in my getting a diagnosis. Even if an owner doesn't recognize that their pet got into it, if I find out that it is within the household, that helps me build more of a picture. I no longer ask, you know, does your dog have access to blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. When I'm questioning about toxins, I specifically say, do you have any blank within your household? Because I've found owners often do not think that their pets have access to it. And later on, we recognize.
Yep. That's been my experience as well. Like, no, they never could have gotten into it. And then it turns out, nope, actually they did.
Yeah. And so like that owner that had dumped all the scraps into their yard, you know, they maybe didn't think about that being access, even as they.
Yeah.
It, the
or
dog
we have clever dogs that get into the garbage. And you don't even know they got into the garbage.
Right. And those tiny little like Chihuahua patients, people that smoke marijuana. They will have, you know, an ashtray with a little like piece of a joint they had. And dogs are exquisitely sensitive to THC. So that tiny little piece or the few little bits that dropped as they were preparing it and are in the carpet, and that might be enough for a mild toxicity in a small dog or even a medium-sized dog. It doesn't take much for them to show some pretty abnormal clinical signs.
So I think that's a really good point to make sure that we're asking targeted questions, you know, along the lines of, do you have this in your house? And not, that's a really important distinction, not to say, does your dog have access? Because I could not agree more that most people don't realize that their dog does have access to this stuff, even if they don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
If we're still in that gray zone of like, is it, isn't it? Or maybe they say, sure, like, absolutely, my dog could have gotten into this, but I don't appreciate them getting into it. I didn't see them get into it. I don't know of anything specific that's missing. And we're still suspicious and we're wondering, do we go down this road? Do we go down another road? Can we use something like an over-the-counter drug test?
You know, great question. And the short answer is yes. And the long answer is, I wish they worked reliably.
Sure.
They can give you a positive. And what I explain to owners is, especially owners that really don't think they could have gotten into it, or, you know, there could be a plethora of medications and drugs and we're not sure what they got into. I offer a urine drug screen, but this is with the awareness that a positive will give us more information. A negative to me does not rule out ingestion at all. And that is because, one, it's a human test and it tests for a metabolite of THC, not the THC itself. And it's testing for that in urine. And dogs actually excrete a lot of this via their, you know, biliary system. About 15 to 17% is excreted in the urine. And it's not always the same metabolite as people. So a yes is great, but a negative means still could be. And I want people to know that before I run the test.
Sure. Yeah. So, that's with any test that's like that, always important to make that distinction of, you know, if we get a negative, we're still on this road. We still have to figure this out and it still could be what we're thinking.
Yeah. And I will say I've had a lot of owners that, you know, maybe when I walk in the room at first and I ask, you know, is there any THC in the home? I notice that like, the husband and wife aren't making eye contact and the husband's averting eyes, looking at the floor, not to single out men. It could be the other way around.
Sure.
But we're the teenage son, you know,
we're a teenage daughter.
Right. You pay attention to their eyes shifting to the corner and, you know, you notice changes in body language, as I think sadly we've all grown skilled at, even though we think about treating the pets, we can read people body language pretty well.
Oh, I think that's part of how we read people body language, is because we have to read the pet's body language so much that we start to look for some of those nonverbal cues.
That's a good point. But, you know, you notice that. And back when I was working in emergency specialty hospitals, you know, you'd say, I think it's a toxin. And if it was bad, yeah, maybe we hospitalize them on IV fluids because we're not sure what toxin. We closely observe. hey, if they're still really neurologic, maybe we have to transfer them to neurology and do an MRI and see, just give them an estimate for what that could look like and walk out of the room and give them like 5 minutes and check back in. And sometimes then they have the realization there was actually marijuana in the household or THC containing products.
Yes, but in particular, I feel like in that situation, I've seen it where, you know, like you said, like the teenage child or something like that, all of a sudden has a moment to have a serious discussion with their parents and say, hey, maybe this happened.
I hate putting people on the spot, but also it really does give me useful information if they'll tell me what their pet could have gotten into.
Absolutely. And keeps us from blowing something off that actually could be really serious.
Right. We need to know if what is possible in those situations. And, you know, especially if it was something containing high levels of THC and the pet is really severely affected, that really makes a difference in how we treat compared to some other toxins.
Yeah, so I'm glad that you said that because that was exactly where my head was going next, of treatment and in particular decontamination, because this can be a little bit nuanced when it comes to THC intoxication.
You're right. And I think it's so important to kind of go through a checklist with any toxin that we see come into us is, you know, ask yourself, should we induce vomiting with this toxin? Because that's not an automatic yes in all situations. There are toxins that can cause more harm to induce vomiting than to just let it be.
Sure.
And with THC, it's not a definitive yes or no, but I'll tell you, in most cases, I did not induce vomiting when seeing these toxicities. One, sometimes patients were already vomiting on their own. That would sometimes be a side effect of this toxicity. And then I didn't want to induce more vomiting. I would actually often use an antiemetic. And if they weren't already vomiting, you then have to worry about their mental state and if their gag response is really there and good. And if you add something like apomorphine, will they still have a good gag and be able to protect their airway? Because to me, dealing with a THC toxicity in most cases is a whole lot better than dealing with aspiration pneumonia.
Sure.
And then there's this little factor of CBD and compounds that are often in these products can also be an antiemetic. So a lot of people use this as an antiemetic. And so even if I want to induce vomiting, it's not always as reliable for THC toxicity.
Right.
If they're not already vomiting.
Yeah, which that was interesting when you said that. I have not ever seen one present vomiting. So that's good to know that that can be a presentation where like it's already coming up and we actually need to stop the vomiting.
Right. Yeah. Sometimes they can get really nauseous from this, which is always a little bit funny because you're like, oh, some people use this as an anti-nausea.
Yeah. And I would say in some of the cases that I've seen, it's been a very effective antiemetic.
Where someone has tried to make them vomit.
Right. Yeah. And it's just not happening no matter what you do.
Yeah. And that is common. And then there's this question about, you know, for every toxicity, okay, first, do we make them vomit? And then activated charcoal, you know, do we give them something like charcoal?
Yeah.
And there's a lot of toxins where charcoal won't be effective, or some toxins where, you know, the risk of giving them a high sodium from giving a lot of charcoal is actually more than just letting the toxin be in their system and deal with it. Time frame from when they ate something affects my decision to give charcoal. And then in the case of THC toxicity, a lot of these patients surprisingly don't have the munchies and don't really want to eat and are also, you know, not necessarily protecting their airway the best. So I often do not use charcoal in management of THC toxicities as well.
Yeah. In my experience, giving charcoal is even like, even if we have a dog who's eating just fine, it can be quite a challenge to get it into them. And I always worry about aspiration with it. Although I have worked with just some absolutely masterful technicians who have, they always seem to manage to get it done. And it's always a messy, good laugh as we go through the whole process. But especially, like you said, in one who, you know, is kind of lethargic and doesn't want to eat and maybe not the most mentally appropriate, that really might not be the best plan. What about for when we're talking about decontamination, if you're concerned about a high level of THC, maybe you have one of these that's really obtunded and you're like, well, no, this is bad, and you want to decontaminate, obviously you can't make that patient vomit. So what about like gastric lavage? And then if you did that, would you administer charcoal down the oral gastric tube?
Perfect question. So gastric lavage, I have actually done in one of these patients. And it, typically I reserve that for those ones, like you said, where they're already very, very obtunded. Like in this case, it was one where his blood gases were actually showing we had to ventilate him anyway. And so he had to be intubated to be on a ventilator. So gastric lavage made sense. Though I will say, I think all of us were surprised that he still had things in his stomach, because this was a case that ate the scraps of making butter and,
wow,
you know, ate large amounts of plant material coated in butter. But it was about 8 hours before presentation. And typically, you think of gastric emptying times and you're like, oh, that would be long gone. Like, there's no point in inducing vomiting. But remember that some things slow down the gut. So, for example, I still induce vomiting with chocolate and raisin toxicities long after, because they seem to stick around the gut a lot longer. And apparently, plant material coated in butter also slow to empty from the gut.
Good to know. Good to know. I also, like, when they're like, gastric emptying time is 30 minutes, I'm like, I don't think so. Not on the x-rays I've seen.
I've gotten chocolate out, like, 6 hours later.
Oh, yeah. Or, like, you take x-rays the next morning and you're like, that is still in there and not a foreign body.
Right. Well, and in this case, I will admit, the dog actually started vomiting a little bit of this before we got to the gastric lavage. And the whole room smelled like we'd all been smoking.
Wow.
And after the gastric lavage, I mean, this was so potent. The entire urgent care and ICU just smelled like we'd all been having a really good party.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, that was a night to remember.
Yes. Buckets of these scraps.
Wow.
And so then in that case, decontamination, great idea. Gonna have them intubated anyway.
What about, you know, we're talking about this being lipid soluble. What about fluid therapy and in particular intralipids?
Really great point. So I've had a lot of success with IV lipid therapy, and there's several papers on it being used in veterinary medicine for fat-soluble things like THC, perfect example. I reserve it for the more severe cases. So, you know, like that one we talked about that was on a ventilator, that one was definitely on IV lipid therapy as well.
Sure.
I've also kept a couple patients off the ventilator. You know, those ones that I mentioned, like I had to poke at them to get them to breathe. And those owners could not have afforded ventilation, but were able to allow us to do some hospitalization and IV lipid. And we were able to get that pet through with just that therapy. And he did great. But a noticeable difference after the IV lipid. The biggest reasons to not do IV lipid is if you spin down their blood, like for a PCV, and you see that it's just severe lipid accumulation already, like if their serum looks white, you probably don't want to do intralipids. It likely won't make a big difference and will add more. So something you have to worry about in the dog that just ate the pans of brownies or the butter that was all over the leaves, you know, do check for that.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, because I would imagine the butter-covered leaves, I would picture this guy having pretty lipemic serum.
Surprisingly, he didn't. Whenever we use intralipid, you know, I do talk to people about, yes, there's some potential for pancreatitis and that's true for this dog anyway, because he just ate tons of butter. but it is something to be aware of.
That is impressive. 8 hours later and he didn't have lipemic serum.
Yeah. I guess it's that good testament to all dogs process things a little bit different sometimes.
Absolutely.
Though there was a study in one case where the pet was very severely affected and had very lipemic serum. And so in that case, they actually ended up using dialysis, basically, to treat the patient. So they couldn't use IV lipid. It would be contraindicated. So they ended up instead doing the hemoperfusion with charcoal and hemodialysis on the 7-month-old lab that survived.
For THC intoxication?
For THC intoxication.
Oh my gosh, that's wild. I can't even imagine like how affected that poor dog had to be. Goodness gracious.
Oh yeah. That patient was apparently having severe hyperesthesia and seizures, so they had to place that one under general anesthesia.
Wow. So, you know, this is a good point that you're making here, because actually where my head was going next, get out of my brain, was prognosis. Because I think a lot of times we really do think about these as minor intoxications. And I think this is, now that we're talking about this, why your presentation stuck with me so much the first time I saw it, was because I think it is easy to brush these off as minor intoxications, but keeping in mind that sometimes these can get severe. So, you know, being aware of that.
Yeah, I think that's part of why this is important. But I also don't want to overly scare people. Prognosis for these guys is usually excellent. Most patients recover within hours to 3 days. I have had some that take, you know, a full 3 days, even in hospital, to recover. But even in the more severe toxicities, you know, even if we have to ventilate them, our patient was off the ventilator in about 12 to 16 hours and went home within a couple days. One of the studies says it's less than 2% are going to have really severe complications or potential
that's what
death.
I read too.
It can happen, but it's not frequent. And so I think most of these patients, like probably 90%, you're going to do supportive care and monitoring and, you know, keep them the right temperature. Like a lot of these, I will send home and I will explain to people, you know, don't use warming blankets, no heating blankets. Don't put like a space heater or heat lamp blasted on them. Because just like patients under anesthesia, they're not going to get up and move if they're getting burnt. But you do want to keep their body temperature supported. So using things like, if they're in hospital, a bear hugger, or if they're at home, towels that the owner keeps putting in the dryer and just keeps near them. And, you know, making sure they stay hydrated, like in hospital, IV fluids, because a lot of them don't want to drink. They want to just be kept in a dark, quiet corner. And if they're going home, you know, some fluids under the skin. In a lot of these patients, I do prefer to send them home because they are so hyperesthetic and will be reactive to every little noise and sound and light, that if I can get them home and feel like owners can keep a close eye on them and they're not severe, then I think that's great. You know, sub-Q fluids, maybe Serenia if they were nauseous or if you induced vomiting. Sometimes you might even need a little bit of like a benzo to help them relax. But most often it's really just time.
I'm trying to picture these dogs with like that are, you know, already high, and then you give them a benzo and I can imagine they don't know what hit them at that point.
Right. Not something common in my experience.
Sure.
But it is something where give them a dark, cozy place. I think from the nursing care aspect, I've had nurses that would make these lovely little eye masks for them.
Aww.
So, yeah, it's really nice. They'd sometimes even draw like eyelids and eyelashes. I really appreciate that. But just like putting a dark mask over their eyes, putting cotton balls in their ears, and letting them sleep it off in dark, quiet peace while you make sure that they stay hydrated and that they don't decline and, you know, get worse and need more support. To me, that's the most important thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, once again, this has been such a good talk. I love talking to you about this topic because you've seen such a variety of different cases that, you know, I think it's really helpful to know the range of presentations and treatment options that we need to be aware of in these patients. What is something, what's like one thing you wish everyone, veterinary professionals, definitely, because that's who we're talking to here, but maybe even pet owners as well, knew about marijuana toxicity in dogs?
I think a good takeaway would be how exquisitely sensitive dogs are to this and how important it is to truly be cautious with any access to not only THC, but medications, drugs, things we don't want them getting into. And then from the veterinary side, not to completely blow off this as a toxin. You know, if someone does come out and tell you, hey, my pet got into THC or got into some product containing THC, find out more information and try to assess the severity, knowing that in rare circumstances, it could be severe. And, you know, not just completely laugh it off and say, yeah, put on a Pink Floyd album, they'll be fine.
Although, fortunately, most of the time, if you do put them in a dark place and put on a Pink Floyd album, they will be okay.
Very true. And it's often benign. So getting an accurate diagnosis can help keep you from going down the rabbit hole of a more serious diagnosis.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, that spoke to me a lot talking to you about that when we were getting ready for this episode of being aware of what to look for, I think really stopped us from going into some serious diagnostics on this most recent case that I saw, because he was an older dog. There was a lot of things that could have happened.
Yeah. And, you know, that can be really scary.
It can be. And even, you know, like knowing the potential for toxicity, we did have an awareness of dosages on this guy and what he got into. And so we were able to call and find out, like, yeah, he's probably going to be fine. We're good to monitor. We don't need to look at any other sort of like decontamination method or anything.
Yeah. I think whenever possible, encouraging people to reach out to poison control is a great idea. Pet poison or ASPCA.
Well, Sarah, this has been so much fun, and I'm really glad that we got together to talk about this topic again, because I love listening to your take on all of this and your experience that you've had with these different patients and these different levels of toxicity. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast with me again, and believe me, I will definitely rope you into another episode if that is doable.
Well, it's so good talking to you, Cassie. I miss working with you.
Ah, same. All right, everyone. Thank you so much for tuning into this episode. I hope you learned a lot. Dr. Smith, thank you for joining me. It's always a pleasure. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts. It'll help other veterinary professionals like yourself find this and other great content we try to put out. If you enjoyed this episode and would like to hear more, click on the education tab on the Vetfolio website. As always, we'd love to hear your input on this talk, as well as ideas for topics you'd like to hear from us in the future. Feel free to reach out to me at dvm@vetfolio.com. You can also visit my Facebook page at Dr. Cassie DVM, and you can find me on LinkedIn. And remember, if one animal is better off because of you today, it's a great day.